Hello, it's Thursday, June the 11th, and this is Israel in 10, the Misgav Daily Brief. I'm Laura Sellier in Tel Aviv. For a second straight day, the United States and Iran have exchanged fire. Today, we'll be talking about that other uneasy ceasefire, the one in Gaza, where millions of civilians remain trapped in misery under the boot of Hamas. Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib is a Gaza native and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He shares his insights in a moment. First, though, the headlines. President Trump has threatened further military action against Iran unless Tehran accepts the US proposal for a deal. It follows a second night of exchanges between the two countries. CENTCOM says it struck Iranian surveillance sites and air defense systems, while Iran fired missiles at American military bases in Jordan, Kuwait and Bahrain. Iran's foreign ministry says the latest US strikes render the ceasefire meaningless. But according to reports, negotiations continue and a team of Qatari mediators left Iran this morning. The casualties from the latest round of fighting include three Indian sailors who were killed after a US strike on a commercial tanker in the Gulf of Oman. The US accused the vessel of violating a blockade on Iranian oil shipments. India has lodged a formal protest with Washington. Meanwhile, in Bahrain, an 11-year-old girl was injured by falling debris after Iranian attacks damaged cars and property. Kuwait briefly closed its airspace but has now reopened it. Mediators in talks to extend a truce in Gaza say they've persuaded Hamas to give up its weapons in exchange for a full IDF withdrawal. The Saudi newspaper Ashaq al-Ofsat reports that mediators are hoping President Trump will pressure Israel to accept the proposal. It calls for the gradual cataloguing and storage of weapons and military infrastructure, and it would proceed according to an agreed timetable that would be accompanied by a full IDF withdrawal and a halt to targeted killings. No response from either Israel nor the United States as yet. The Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has lifted a five-year ban on imports from Lebanon. The move could signal a broader rapprochement between Riyadh and Beirut after years in the deep freeze over Iran's influence. Bin Salman announced the decision during a phone call with Lebanon's Prime Minister Nawaf Salam, and he reaffirmed Saudi support for Lebanon's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Well, before we get to today's conversation, a quick reminder, you can sponsor Israel in 10. Just drop us a line at misgavdailybrief@gmail.com. Now here's Gaza native and senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, Ahmed Fouad Al-Khatib, on how to build a new Gaza. Later this month, there's going to be an anti-Hamas rally in Gaza. Isn't that extremely dangerous?
Very much so. I mean, this was inevitable. I predicted when the ceasefire was signed and I knew that Hamas was not going to disarm. I knew that Hamas was going to stall for time, re-entrench its rule, re-establish its presence at different levels of Gazan society. And so it was inevitable that the frustration within the Gazan population, 70% of whom are in tents, 20% of whom are displaced internally, not to mention the cessation of a lot of the basic services like sanitation, the crowding, the trash, the rubble, the rodents, the heat, the lack of electricity, layers upon layers upon layers of suffering and hardships that have failed to be resolved in large part because Hamas won't disarm, won't clear the path for the new technocratic government, won't make way for a true transitional process that can begin the stabilization of Gaza. And so finally, now in June, the anger, the oppressive summer heat, I predicted, would really accentuate just the misery and the hardships. I've been trying to look into who really is organizing them. I wanted to get a sense of who's actually behind them. And they really seem to be headless, organic, flat, by a group of social media activists that got together and agreed on this date. Now, we know it's dangerous because some of my own friends have actually been beaten almost to death. It is dangerous. It is potentially life-threatening. The amount of incitement that Hamas and its sycophants in Gaza, in the West Bank, some in the Arab street, some even here in the Western world, the pro-Palestine community who are already calling these people traitors, collaborators, Zionist tools, and actively calling for shooting them and eliminating them on site. It's a very risky business, and I commend these people.
Can you talk a bit about the areas in Gaza that are not under Hamas control? What is the situation like there?
It's helpful to think of it in just overly simplistic, let's say, color schemes. So there's the red zone that's controlled by Hamas, and that's where the grand overwhelming majority, almost like 98%, of Gaza's population lives. Then there is the yellow line that separates the Hamas-controlled territory from the rest of the Gaza Strip, where the Israeli military and the State of Israel control that area. And that's loosely referred to as the Green Zone. That area has upward of 10,000 are the estimates. I mean, really small numbers of people that are mainly the families of anti-Hamas militias. There are five anti-Hamas militias distributed across the Green Zone. Some of them have their families. They have large agricultural lands, etc. Some of them are Bedouins. And so these areas, if you will, have, after the ceasefire, been looked at as the promised land, areas where we could begin to develop some alternative to Hamas's rule. There were different philosophies. Some thought that this is a long-term project where you really develop those areas and you make them very compelling, something akin to East or West Germany. Some people thought that at minimum, you should just build alternative humanitarian zones with better health and education facilities. You can begin to do de-radicalization. You clear those areas from the rubble, from tunnels, from unexploded munitions, and you begin slowly draining Hamas from having access to a large pool of human shields. The thought was you use the Green Zone, which after the ceasefire was 53% of Gaza's territory. As of 2 weeks ago, it was 60%. Prime Minister Netanyahu just gave orders to the IDF to expand it to 70%. So we're talking about the IDF holding two-thirds of Gaza's territory versus the red zone that Hamas controlled being one-third, and that's where roughly 2 million people are. We haven't really seen the kind of development in the green zones that would begin to create Hamas-free zones, the kind of spaces where Gazans can breathe a sigh of relief. That's what I've been pushing for heavily in Washington.
Well, Ahmed, if that is not working out, what is the way out of this?
Israel has what it didn't when October 7th had, which is control of well over half of the Gaza Strip's territory. That is not only precious real estate, but you can also actually do a lot with that area. You remember how the rest of the world refused to let Gazans leave, and we had Egypt close its borders and say, no, you can't leave. And that compounded the horrendous suffering and the casualties because civilians were trapped in an active combat zone and Hamas was hiding behind them. The IDF was doing all these big strikes in Yemen and Sudan and Afghanistan and Ukraine, in Syria. People get to flee the war zone, except only in Gaza. The bigger concern is, oh, well, you're never going to be able to return back to your home. So therefore, we'd rather you die in your territory than somehow, you know, letting you live abroad. But nevertheless, you asked about the pathway forward. I think it starts with developing beyond yellow line development zones, model camps, model communities, these spaces where they can be truly free of Hamas. You can have a new security apparatus. All of this is achievable. And yes, the Board of Peace hasn't been able to raise the kinds of funds like the 17 billion pledges. There's been some money here and there. Nevertheless, it's just a small stepping stone that you can use for something resembling a broad Gaza administration. The United Arab Emirates 2 weeks ago gave $100 million to the Board of Peace, just earmarked just for the new Gaza police. Everybody's so caught up in the broader infrastructure, just it being this big top down, we're going to have the government figured out, and then we're underneath it, we're going to have the security, and then here's the police and blah, blah, blah. I'm much more willing to experiment, to do ad hoc, to basically save and improve lives in the immediate term, create the nucleus for the new Gaza. The Board of Peace and Nikolai Mladenov, who's the chairman of the executive committee, they didn't want the developments to take place in the green zone that Israel controls. They wanted the new projects to begin happening in the red zone, the Hamas-controlled zone, so that, you know, they're not seen as working in Israeli-controlled territory. They're not seen as coming on the backs of Israeli tanks. Which I argue is nonsense, because whether it's the green zone or the red zone, this is Gazan territory that we ultimately want to develop so that it's free of terror, free of Hamas, and so that it can be developed and eventually Israel is going to withdraw. So Now they're saying, oh, well, since Hamas is not disarming, since Hamas is not willing to allow...
Surprise.
I said that like back in October, we're willing to now experiment with development beyond the yellow line. So that's where I think the only opening we have at the tactical level, we need to improve lives.
That's it. That's your Israel in 10. Your next episode will drop on Tuesday. Until then, thanks for watching. And please do subscribe using the link below. Goodbye.